Now it's time for the Southern Cross with Kendall Hutt.
So we are joined by Kendall Hutt, who is interviewing the international president of the woman, the president of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Kazuyi Akibayashi. Would you like to start off with the first question, Kendall?
So the first question is, the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty was adopted on July 7. It's the first legally binding international agreement to comprehensively prohibit nuclear weapons, with the goal of leading towards their total elimination. 69 nations did not vote, and the bulk of those nations are nuclear weapon states and NATO members. So I was just wondering, how much of a victory is this Weapons Ban Treaty really for nuclear-free advocates?
Oh, we think this is a big victory. Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the oldest women's international peace organization that have existed for over 100 years, have been working on disarmament all the time. And after the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, our focus was also devoted to nuclear disarmament. And yes, that there are those countries who are not party to the negotiation, who did not participate in negotiation of the treaty, and it is our task to increase the number of those who will be joining the treaty once signing and ratification procedure it started on September 20th, nuclear weapon has not been recognized as something that has to be banned. Very different status from other weapons of mass destruction, like biological weapons and so forth, or cluster munitions and so forth. So it is very important for us to say that it is a norm that the majority of the governments agreed to illegalize nuclear weapons, not only the usage, but in the development and so forth. And it was very important that the term deterrence was included in the deterrence. It is not should not be tolerated, and that was very important in the treaty. Also, in the preamble, there's a term hibakusha that was originally used to refer to the victims of the Hiroshima Nagasaki bombings, but to later. Broaden the meaning to include those who were exposed to radiation, including nuclear testing and so forth. So that is also an important aspect of that treaty.
And New Zealand is one of the nations who voted yes to this nuclear weapons ban treaty. Mm-hmm. And being nuclear free for 30 years, do you think that New Zealand needs to take more of a lead in ensuring that this treaty is ratified in September?
Of course. Of course. I think New Zealand has a very unique experience and history and relation, in particular in the Asia Pacific. Japan, where I come from, did not participate in the negotiation. Which is a very, very shame. And there's a lot of work that the Japanese citizens have to do in order for our government to bring them into the ratification process, but to play a role between nuclear states and non-nuclear states, with their unique experience. So Japan has a very important role as well. But I do think New Zealand, the Japanese government can or should work more closely with such government as New Zealand to make this treaty not really meaningful, but to realize this treaty.
So can I just ask, what sort of things do you think the New Zealand government needs to do to sort of help promote this treaty? Should we be reaching out to countries that aren't on board, and should we be trying to get them on board with it?
You have the new. You have 30 years. This is your 30th anniversary of a nuclear-free zone, and that, I think that something like that needs to be more widely shared, that a nuclear-free zone has to be expanded, and the New Zealand government's experience of having been in a nuclear-free zone for the past 30 years, can be promoted and share the stories what it has meant for the people to live in a nuclear-free zone, which I think is very, very important. It's very different probably to live in the situation where there's always a possibility of a nuclear weapon introduction in your own soil. So I think that's part of the something that I can think of about what or would like to see what New Zealand government will be doing.
Yeah.
And do you think that, or do you feel that Wolf and nuclear-free advocates in New Zealand will ensure that the New Zealand government sort of does step up to the plate on this nuclear issue?
Yes, of course. We have a section, a very strong section, in New Zealand Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has a very strong section in New Zealand with the several branches, and I am sure, and they have been working on nuclear disarmament for many, many years. Yesterday on the Hiroshima Day, I was very touched to be present at the Hiroshima Day in New Zealand. So I was talking to my friends back home that, you know, the people in New Zealand is commemorating Hiroshima, and you know that should be more widely known, particularly to Japan too. We don't really assume even in Japan that many people commemorate Hiroshima. We know about that, but it's so easy to forget as well. And our section's efforts over the years is very, very important.
The U.S. was among several nuclear weapon states who were not in favor of this historic treaty. Mm-hmm. What does this say about the absence of demilitarization across the globe, something that Wolf is campaigning for?
Will has been campaigning for demilitarization, disarmament, and demilitarization. Demilitarization is about is not only about not having the military, but it's about the values, how we see, how we support the idea of solving disputes or differences by non-violent means or not using force. It will be a long way to gain wider support for this idea, to implement this idea. In fact, I think the idea itself has been supported by many people. I think many people understand that it's important. But when it's so easy to be bought into this logic of a threat. When you don't really actually see the threat, and the actual threat is more about your daily lives. The security. When you talk about security, we always think about the border. I think border protection is your issue as well. Border or somebody, having possibility of launching a missile and so forth. But in return, our security of our daily lives have been undermined. More probably practically, we talk about we should talk more about how our resources or the budget are allocated to what is the current security policies, our current security policies assure the safety and security and well-being or even livelihood or survival of people of your country. This kind of, I think, question needs to be asked more frequently and more explicitly to those who are in power, and that includes, of course, the United States as well. So the networking, I think, is networking of these demilitarization of our thinking or of our security policies is one of the most important ways to reach out to those who have massive military power.
And keeping with the U.S., they have numerous military bases throughout the Pacific, mm-hmm. but I did want to talk more about Okinawa. Mm-hmm. The island contains 96% of the U.S. forces stationed in Japan, and that base has played critical roles, in the Korean, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq wars, which you were talking about last mm-hmm. night. But what has the impact of this essentially military occupation had on the people of Okinawa?
I don't know if I got the number correct. it's over 70% of the U.S. military facilities exclusively used by the U.S. military, located in the entire Japan, is on Okinawa, which only consists 1% of the entire land area as well as population. This has been, of course, the impacts vary, including environmental destruction and water contamination. That includes water contamination, or wildfire, soil erosion. That could be very detrimental to agriculture and fishing. Also, social problems have been there. My activity has been focused on sexual violence by U.S. soldiers that has been going on since 1945, or probably even before, and they don't feel safe living with this active foreign military only a fence away from their community. There are so many aspects of their lives that are damaged by the presence of the U.S. military, because that has the utmost priority in whatever they do, and they enjoy even almost diplomatic immunity in committing crimes and sexual violence. Of course, I'm sure you're aware, is one of the more difficult crimes to be dealt with, even in the existing judicial system, and that is doubled by the presence of the U.S. superiority legally. There has been justice brought to many victims and survivors of U.S. soldiers' crimes, some sexual violence by U.S. soldiers. So those are one of those few examples of the actual impacts that Okinawan people have to live with for the past 70 years and more.
Sure. That would be incredibly disheartening to be living in sort of basically a military state around Okinawa when the U.S. soldiers have complete control over everyone in the area. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. But thank you so much for coming on air, and it's been lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was the Southern Cross.